We get the hour underway like we do each Tuesday by welcoming in our friend, writer Colin Fleming. Hello there, Colin.
Hey, what's up, Rich?
Well, we're celebrating yet another 50th anniversary in Beatleland today, and you've written a terrific piece about the Beatles. Is it safe to say oft maligned, Let It Be?
Yes, I think we could say that that is indeed how the album is regarded, but it's almost like something has to be worse, right? You figure something has to come in last place. So I don't know if it's so much flagged off as it is just separated from the rest of the Beatles album heard. But consensually, I would say that, yeah, people would rate this album, which came out on May 8th, 1970. It's kind of confusing in the chronology, which we'll get to, but they would rate this as the worst Beatles album. And I think most Beatles albums, this is going to be if we're not counting Yellow Submarine, which was really only a Beatles album in half. But most Beatles albums, beyond the obvious masterpieces of A Revolver, Rubber Soul, which I know you like, you can at least stump for. You can make a dark horse argument as any given album as the Beatles' best album. Like, we could do this with, say, Please Please Me. And you could say, all right, it's their set list performed in the studio, and it's this mishmash of covers and originals, but it has this raucousness to it, this intensity, this winsome power that elevates it above other Beatles albums. We could take Beatles for Sale and say it has this autumnal quality to it, this copper sun sort of feeling to it, of this fatigue and this world weariness, and yet the music still being this kind of ray that breaks through those clouds. So we can do it even with those dark horses, but we really struggle when we try, I think, to do it with Let It Be.
And the knock on it a lot of people have had is that, well, look, the band was pretty much broken up already. It was a lot of individual performances here. And yet, as you point out, one of my favorite tracks, maybe my favorite on the whole album, is the surprisingly rare opportunity to hear John and Paul harmonize.
Right. That's with the opener, Two of Us. And you would think, because I bet people right now just did a double take when they heard you say that, think like those two guys sing together all the time. Meh, kind of. What they don't very often do is duet together. One will take the vocal lead and the other will harmonize. And it's a testament to the way their voices matched and yet remain separate that when that's occurring, it's difficult to actually tell. You really have to know their music pretty well and be accustomed to hearing them. Know how to hear them, I would say, to know who is actually doing the harmony part. So they don't duet that often. They duet when they do, very memorably. So If I Fell is a good example of a duet. This Boy doesn't fit the bill because they're singing with Harrison, Lennon and McCartney, so it's really the trio going at it. You have a duet on The Ballad of John and Yoko, which is telling, because that's when they were really coming apart, and a friendship between McCartney and Lennon was coming apart. So it's notable that when that tends to happen, they return to a duet. Same thing with Hey Jude. Hey Jude has my favorite duet when it comes right before the big extended coda. Listen carefully. They will sing together on this song that Lennon interpreted as being McCartney's way of saying to him, look, you can leave me. You can leave the band. You don't have to be a part of this anymore. And here near the end, we're not quite at the end yet. We're in January of 1969 when they're cutting these Let It Be sessions. And they do the song Two of Us. It's the opener on the album, and it's an Everly Brothers via Nick Drake kind of outing. And in one of the outtakes, McCartney jokingly says to Lennon, take it, Phil, as if it's just this direct homage to the Everly Brothers, but they're singing about themselves, really. It's not like this limited autobiography, but they're talking about chasing paper, and that would be all of the contractual rabble that was going on with them at the time and that they were trying to get through. And really, they're singing about themselves, and they're singing about a way to end the band. I think people underestimate how powerful a goodbye is. A goodbye can be every bit as powerful as that initial hello when something that's going to last for a while begins. And the way we disseminate our goodbyes, and the way we handle our goodbyes says a lot about the relationships we had that we may be leaving, but they live on in a certain way, because relationships are really a three-part sort of deal. They're between you and the other person, and they also belong to a point in time. And the Beatles were wise enough, even with that opener, to recognize that.
And the Beatles, as we learn more about them through the years with various biographies and autobiographies and video productions, we learn that, like most friendships, it wasn't that simple. It didn't have a simple beginning or a simple ending. There were highs and lows and ins and outs. And, you know, toward the end of John Lennon's life, there had been some sort of a rapprochement. They had begun to mend some fences and it at least reached some understanding of what they meant to each other in their lives. And that certainly reflected 10 years earlier in Two of Us.
If you knew where to look, that information was there all along. It just might not have been in some of the more accepted official sources. You can read things like, people don't even know it exists. They probably still don't even know if many people know it exists that much now. You can read John Lennon's letters from before they were famous.
Right.
Things of that nature that hardly anyone is aware of, his letters to Stuart Sutcliffe. And there was a book that came out early on in the Beatles' progress, which was part of the subtitle. And the book was called Love Me Do, and it was written by a guy who went out on tour with the Beatles, and the Beatles didn't really expect to last, because all of these things were short-term deals. And this guy wrote this book is how they really were, and the way they really were when they were conquering America, as it were, wasn't that dissimilar to how they were in 1969. They have this shared interest, and that interest is this love of rock and roll. And it's like, think of that rink rat. That guy who will not leave the rink, right? He'll play scrimmage with anybody. He loves hockey like few people are ever fortunate to love anything in life. And I think part of the reason of the closeness of these four men, and these two men in particular, was that they had this shared love for something else. Again, it's like these patterns of triangles. You have Lennon, McCartney, rock and roll. And without that rock and roll, that friendship probably doesn't exist. But if you love something so much, more than anyone else conceivably that you might meet will, who do you get to share that with? When you find someone who has that and who doesn't get sick of you just loving something so hard, that relationship is going to last. And that relationship, too, when it's highly competitive, which is what this relationship was,
right.
I think it was more of a professional relationship than it was a kind of brother relationship like Lennon had with Sutcliffe, or even a guy named Pete Shotton. But who else were you? Look, I crave belonging with somebody, but I will read something by Keats and think, I would love to hang out with you. That would be good. We would be like buddies. And so I'm always searching for something like that. And these two guys found that. And that connection is like the nature of any great connection. It never goes away. You cannot talk to somebody for 30 years. And when you do talk to them again, you're going to be right back in the pocket. It's just the nature of a powerful connection.
We're talking with Colin Fleming here on Downtown Day. You've got a great analogy in your piece on Let It Be. You say, with Let It Be, we have the musical analog of King Solomon deploying his blade, cleaving the Beatles' baby into two thematic halves. Can you explain that?
Sure. With every Beatles album, no matter how much is going on it, with the exception of Let It Be, there's a kind of linear identity, is what I would call it. Now, you take something like the White Album, be like, no, how could that possibly be? They're in two dozen different styles, right? They're country and western, avant-garde, jazz, heavy metal, Beach Boys, rockabilly, so many different things, Broadway show tunes, that kind of deal. But that album's identity was this flex of saying, look at all the variegated styles we can do and put together. Sgt. Pepper was a kind of let's play make-believe day at school today type of thing. There was an Edwardian futurism, I would say, to Revolver. You have the set list, like we talked about, of Please Please Me, in the studio with that first record. With the Beatles was the rhythm and blues record. Hard Day's Night was the perfect pop record, and so on. With Let It Be, we don't really have that. We have this return to their roots, as they put it, but not really a full-on return. You have them at Twickenham Film Studios tooling around in all sorts of covers, some of them not rendered very well, but nowhere near as bad as like the official biography will have you believe. It's all very listenable. And you have that return to earlier songs like One After 909, which dates to, they were trying to record that in March of 1963 for George Martin. They couldn't get it together. And then you have Phil Spector coming in. And Phil Spector takes the tapes, so he's not really there. And he's just going to ladle on these strings, some of it, but not all of it. So you have this kind of I Pick a Moondog deal going on, and that's Lennon referencing intertextuality. When they were Johnny and the Moondogs, when they couldn't think of a good name, and then ironically they thought it was like the best name anyone ever had. It took them forever to get it. And then you have the Phil Spector wall of sound, but the wall of sound without those huge drums that you get on the Ronettes recording. So you have the record going in a couple different directions at once. But it's funny because as much as that Phil Spector production is maligned, I never really noticed it that much. I guess you noticed it in The Long and Winding Road, but McCartney had a sketch, and that filled in some of the background when there was a lot of foreground, just that ballad foreground. But I always sort of just hear the Beatles. I guess it's because I love something like the BBC Sessions. The BBC Sessions is this assemblage of many different kinds of music and sound quality, and that's how Let It Be is, in a sort of studio. We're in this film studio kind of way. We're up on the roof at Apple kind of way. It's not a homogenous sound, but life isn't akin to a homogenous sound, right? And this is very much a Beatles life album, I think.
Yeah, and you say that this was the movie itself and everything that went into those sessions was in many ways a search for direction.
The movie is always flagged off. In fact, the movie, it's like, this is Soviet Russia. It's like hidden behind these curtains, and you've always struggled to see this film. Now this Peter Jackson film is going to come out, and it's going to whitewash reality because everything now is feels, and it has to be happy, 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 smiley face. This was neither happy, happy, smiley face, nor like, oh man, this is just the worst thing ever. It was a band trying to figure out early in the morning with film crews documenting them what direction to take next. And there's this moment in the film where McCartney, who's in this de facto role of taskmaster, cheerleader, energy source, because it fell to him, because they would have stopped earlier, I think, without him. We wouldn't have this record. We wouldn't have Abbey Road. We might not have had the White Album. So there's three albums right there that might never have occurred, and probably wouldn't have had Magical Mystery Tour. And so McCartney says to Lennon, remember back in 1961, he doesn't say the year, but that's what the year was. And we were doing this residency at this club, and we were terrified, and nobody was there, but we were awful the first night. We couldn't get over our nerves. The second night, we were a little bit better. And then we got better and better and better as it went along, and more people showed up. Lennon looks like he wants to leave, like he doesn't want to be there. But what McCartney's doing is he's saying, we're scared right now. We're rimrocked. We don't know how to go up. We don't know how to go down. We don't know what to do. So I think that's something that is maybe the most honest remark the Beatles ever made on celluloid. And it speaks to how relatable, I mean, God is relatable. The sun is relatable. Everything is relatable if it's dealing with you honestly, no matter if you think something's really far removed from your life. Because the way McCartney's describing that fear, that anxiety, that inability to get started, everyone has that to some degree at some point in their life, and sometimes at long stretches. And here were the Beatles at the end of their time, the most famous four men in the world, arguably, and they're frightened. They're all four frightened, even these two guys.
You point out, too, that the version that we usually hear of Let It Be is the single version. You got to listen to the album version and get the real deal.
Yeah, the version you will hear on the radio is going to be the 45. You don't often, sometimes in classic rock stations, I don't even know if I don't listen to the radio. I don't know if it's still around. But whenever I used to hear Let It Be on the radio, it has this very tepid George Harrison solo. And it's funny because on those sessions from March 1963, when they're trying to do One After 909, Lennon at one point, when the solo just falls to bits, he turns to Harrison. You can hear him off mic say, what kind of solo was that? Because it sounds like he's playing a rubber. But they even say it sounds like you're playing a rubber band. I mean, these guys are like kind of ruthless with each other. But the solo, the guitar solo on One After 909,
the 1969 Let It Be version is great, but the guitar solo on Let It Be is not the album version, isn't what you'd expect, because it's this very churchified number. In the piece, I said that it's a song that we could imagine Sam Cooke writing, right, if he'd lived a little bit longer.
Right.
Paul McCartney wasn't that far removed at times from the church, even though the Beatles were such secular, unlike, say, Elvis, secular musicians. The guitar solo by Harrison, it's all this fuzz box and everything. It's actually louder than the rest of the music around it. I don't know many guitar solos. I can't think of one offhand where it's actually the loudest piece of music in the music. Because normally what happens in any given piece of music, everything is kind of in the same volume ballpark. Not here. And then after he's done soloing, it's pretty outrageous. He keeps doing these fills on the fade, which is a lot like Eric Clapton on the end of While My Guitar Gently Weeps. Mm-hmm. But at this point, Harrison's a better guitar player than Eric Clapton, for a little while at least, and he just goes to volume town, and you have this church song, and you have this raving, screaming guitar tone, and it's just, again, it's incongruous, but it works. It all ends up fitting in the end.
Revisit the album, give it a new listen, watch the movie, and we'll see what Peter Jackson does with it in the fall, if it is indeed all those smiley faces. But most of all, go to the Daily Beast, out soon, Colin's analysis of both the album and the film of Let It Be. Colin, thanks as always, my friend. We'll catch up with you next week.
Okay, sounds good.
Colin Fleming with us here on Downtown. And of course, go to his website, colinflemminglit.com, and visit the Many Moments More blog.